Hey, thanks for tuning in to another episode of the How to Become an Elite Financial Advisor podcast. I wanted to extend a personal invitation. If you had questions about coming to our How to Charge Live event in April of 2025, that you would go to howtocharge.live.com. That's howtocharge.live.com. Click on a button there that says schedule the call. And I'd love to answer any questions you have about coming to our event in April. It will sell out, but if you have questions, I want to answer them as quickly as possible so you can get your seat to that event. I look forward to seeing you here with us in April. And now, enjoy today's episode. Well, hello, friends. Welcome to another episode of the Elite Advisor Podcast. I'm here with a new friend, Chloe Moore. Chloe, how are you today?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. One of the things that we love to do, because we get to interact with so many different advisors, is just give them a chance to tell their story. One of the reasons we do that for you, the listener, or for you, the viewer, if you're watching on YouTube, is we just want to help you know you're not alone, that as lonely as this industry is, that there are many people out there doing great things that you can learn from and be connected to. So I wanted to ask you right off the bat, and this is not bragging because I asked, so you're allowed to just, you know, answer it directly. What do you feel like you're really good at as an advisor?
Yeah, so I feel like I have two major strengths as it relates to helping my clients and growing my business. The first is my ability to relate and connect with my clients. I work primarily with tech employees that have equity compensation, but also a lot of my clients are kind of first generation to make this much money or go to college.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are in minority groups, so either women, people of color, LGBTQ community. And so I just have a great ability to connect with them on a personal level, and they feel at ease, and basically like that there's a safe and open environment where they can share, you know, their experiences and not feel judgment.
Yeah. So I want to dive into that one. I know there's another one, but I want to dive into this one for a few minutes. Is that something you feel like you've always been good at, you're innately good at? Or is it that plus you've also worked on it?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. I do feel like I've kind of just always had that quality.
Sure.
Myself. And yeah, people just often come up to me and start sharing their stories or sharing information about themselves. And so yeah, I mean, that's just something that, you know, I've always had.
Right.
But I've also worked very hard to be a good listener and to make sure that I ask very thoughtful questions and just, you know, how I have conversations to make sure that people feel seen and heard.
So two questions then out of that. What have you done to get better at that? Or is there an online influencer you follow? Is there a book you've read? Or is there just sort of a practice that you have adopted to improve at that? And then how do you know when it's working? How do you know when the connection is happening?
Yeah, so that's also been just a combination of things as far as how I've learned. I've done some training. I'm not completely through with it, but some training with George Kinder, and working, you know, through getting eventually the registered life planning designation. And I do read a lot of, you know, just behavioral finance books. I'm kind of a behavioral finance junkie, so I listen to a lot of different podcasts, and even listening to financial coaches is very helpful, and kind of learning coaching practices, because that really helps to, you know, answer the right or ask the right questions and see how you can pull things out of people just by asking the right questions. So just listening to other people who are great at this type of work.
What's the benefit of asking the right questions? Like, what does that mean on a practical level for you in an appointment where you're like frustrated and then you ask the right question, you're like, bam, they gave me that information and here's how it helps me and helps them. Like, what does it look like when that's working well? And what does it look like if it's not going well?
Yeah, a great example is just in a situation where you want to get to the root of an issue. Let's say a client, you know, comes to me and they have spending issues. Like, they make great income and they have, you know, all the potential to do great things with their money. But,
you know, let me just interrupt real quick. That is dicey ground, right? That's like, my kids used to play this game called The Floor is Lava. where everything, you know, you had to jump from piece of furniture. Like, that's the floor is lava kind of thing, where it's like, hey, now we're going to talk about how you spend your money on yourself. So anyway, that's, everyone is on their edge of the seat, because this is something where you might go, oh, okay, well, so, oh, so you spend it all. Okay, well, all right, moving on. So what do you do to not move on?
Yeah. So, so some of it is just learning about their experiences growing up with money, you know, how they saw their parents or other people around them manage money. And so, I mean, even just having those conversations help them to connect maybe with some of the things that they're doing today, you know, based on what they saw. Some of the other piece of it is just creating a level of awareness. So, you know, I start with every client. Even if they don't have spending issues, we start out by looking at where's their money actually going. Because, you know, as you know, like once you get to the point where you're making so much money, you know, you might not track your budget, you know, exactly. And so, so just having that awareness of this is where your money has gone over the last 6 or 12 months, and they can see broad categories and areas where, you know, maybe those areas aren't as important to them, or you know, these, or they didn't realize they were spending money in certain areas. And so, so just asking reflective questions, like, you know, looking at this information, are there places where you wish you spent more money? Are there, you know, areas where you wish you spent less money?
That's I love the more question, because usually it's less, spend less, you know? And I like starting with that. So do people ever say, yes, I wish I would spend more? If so, what do they say?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times it's the experiences. So yeah, they wish they would spend more on experiences and maybe less on things. But it's different for everyone. You know, everyone has, you know, certain things that they really enjoy spending money on. And so, so it's really just me trying to help them understand, okay, what are your core values? What are the things that make you happy, that make your life feel fulfilled? And how can we spend more money on those things? And then these things that don't matter, that you're just mindlessly, you know, swiping your card for, or clicking online and making purchases, let's see if we can cut those things back.
What are the most common things that you find that people spend an exponentially large amount of money on that they could adjust?
Just online shopping is a big thing, because it's so convenient just to go online and have something delivered to your house in 1 or 2 days.
I was going to say an hour, you know. Yeah. I know you're in the Atlanta area, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we're outside right now, you know, like just, yeah, click whatever you want and we'll drop it. Yeah. I've also seen that one of the largest areas, as we work with advisors, that, you know, we hear about our vehicles right now of helping people understand. But that's, again, it's a difficult topic to get into, but, you know, that can take up a pretty massive percentage of their income. What are some ways that you've navigated guiding, not telling, but maybe guiding people? Is it just that reflective, like they have to see it themselves, versus you say, you know, well, that's dumb, don't do that anymore. You know, like, is the reflective line of questioning effective to get them to go, huh, I probably don't need a $1,500 car payment or $1,000 a month on Uber Eats. I could like walk down the steps and get it myself. I mean, how's that effective, and how do you help people get there?
Yeah, it really is just asking those questions and creating a level of awareness, and then asking those questions to help them, you know, kind of come to those conclusions on their own and see, you know, what really makes sense, or what's most important. A lot of our money decisions are emotional sometimes, or just, you know, we just go on autopilot. And so when you have that chance to really take a step back and think through, you know, what are you doing and how does this have an impact on you in the short term and in the long term, that can really create some change.
So when someone has significant funds for the first time, meaning their parents didn't, and so they weren't instructed on how to handle that, or maybe their parents did make good money but they spent it all too, what do you see them doing? Do they just mimic their parents usually, or you know, what does that look like? And again, these people could be, I guess, in their 30s at this point, and so they've been spending money like that for, you know, a decade. What do you, What can you do to understand that? You literally just say, hey, did your parents have money? Like, what kind of questions are you asking them to understand, oh, that's why they're acting that way?
Yeah. I have a long list of questions that I ask.
Oh, really?
The very first meeting that I have with clients, the entire hour is just a conversation to learn more about them. So I do start with the, basic, like, tell me about, your family, how you grew up, where you come from, all those things.
Do you think most advisors ask that question?
Probably not, but yeah.
I just think it's fascinating because we talk to a lot of advisors, and I think that you ask a lot of advisors talk about a client, but they don't ask, that far back, which is essentially saying, what kind of soil did you grow up in?
Yeah.
And that might explain how they handle the fruit. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's great. Keep going. That's great.
Yeah. And then just early experiences with money that they remember growing up. If they like decisions that they've made so far, like in their adult life that they're proud of, things that they regret. Kind of how do they envision their life? Like, what are some of their long-term goals, or how do certain things that they mention play a role? So, if they really want to give back, how does that play a role in your life now? And how do you see that changing over time?
Yeah. So let me tap into maybe an objection that some people might be having. I don't have it, but I think others might. They say, hey, like, I don't know if people are going to want to talk about those things. Right. Do you run into that people don't want to share that?
I have on occasion, but someone that's going to be my client, these are the types of things that we have conversations about.
I love that.
So yeah, it's something that's important to me to understand who you are at your core. And it helps with accountability, down the road. So I have, clients, maybe some things happen and they have a few setbacks, but like to be able to go back and remind them, this is what we talked about and this is what you said was important to you. So let's make sure that we get back on track.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a level of intentionality and frankly, depth of the relationship that I think that advisors often don't give themselves permission to tap into. I mean, you're not scolding them. You're just saying, hey, remember what we talked about? Remember what you said was a priority? I was working on a training that we're going to be giving. By now it'll be over, I was working on the notes for it, and one of the lines of it was, get paid for your time, your ideas, and the accountability you provide. And it's not that you're going to send me your checking statement, it's not that you're asking them to call you before they go out to dinner, but it is is what you want aligning with how you're acting. So those are big questions to have. That's great. I love that. And I think that that would help a lot of advisors if they went a layer deeper than sort of their generation and kind of go like, what generation are they coming from? Mm-hmm. What was their household like? Is that usually give you all the information you need to know about how they handle money? Does that usually explain pretty much everything?
I mean, it gives me a good foundation for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Give me a quick story if you would. It's kind of on the spot. So if you don't have one, it's all right. We'll edit it out. But do you have an idea of like, boy, this was really interesting. They were acting this way with money. And then you ask the questions and you're like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. There's a lot. It's like one that's great with behavior change is I had a client who was previously had a business, and then she started, and it was before we started working together. And it didn't work out. It failed. And then she started working with me, and she had by that time she was working, full-time W-2 employee. Uh-huh. And she wanted to take the leap again and start a business.
Hmm.
And so we did a lot of planning and strategy, and she told me multiple times, when I tried to start this business before, like almost went through bankruptcy, like it almost ruined
me.
And so,
yeah.
And so she's like, I don't want to go back there. And so we worked really hard to make sure that she, had the proper savings and cushion, and, very deliberate about how she was managing things as she started to build this business.
Yeah. That's awesome. So let's talk about the other thing that I think you do well, is your network. And this is something that I think advisors really struggle with putting a value on, or even frankly seeing value in it. It's sort of like, oh yeah, I connect with my clients with the right people. You know, we teach advisors that you should be charging for that, or at least market that as part of the services you provide, is the connections you have. Can you give us, maybe to start with, a few stories or examples of a client comes to you and has an issue and you immediately go, I got you. Well, no problem. We'll take care of that. But you're not doing it, right? You're going to, you taking care of it is you picking up the phone and saying, hey, Jamar, like, you know, hey, Mary, you know, like whoever, right? What's an example that you run into routinely and you go, I got it. No problem. I got my gal. I get on the phone. She'll take care of you. What's a common interaction like for you and a client?
Well, I'll say, even just to take a step back from that, I tried to be very intentional. I think most advisors, you want to have at least a CPA or some sort of tax preparer and estate planning attorney. Mm-hmm. For their clients. And so with those two core relationships, I tried to be very intentional with finding people who I felt could also relate to my clients. So and a lot of my clients, you know, it's important to them to work with a woman, mm-hmm. or work with a person of color or someone who's LGBTQ friendly. And so I made a point to go out and find those people and have that solid base of people that I could refer to in those two categories. And then when it came to other things, I also wanted to build a network with other financial advisors. I have a very specific niche, and I turn away a lot of business, you know, because they're not in my niche. So I have other advisors that I can refer to who, you know, complement, you know, what I do, or maybe are in a totally different niche, and mm-hmm. and who would be a good fit. And they're all over the country, and so. So if I have clients who are outside of the state of Georgia, for example, and I need an estate planning attorney, I will contact some of my colleagues and say, hey, I have a client who lives in California, in the San Diego area. Do you know of anyone who could help them with their estate documents, or they're getting married? Do you know anyone that can help them with a prenup? So that's the first piece, is just, you know, making those connections with not only the core advisors, but other financial advisors and colleagues as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me speak to, again, like kind of a fear that people might have when they hear that, because again, it sounds great to be clear on this is who I serve, but it also is like, I'm going to say no to a lot. I'm saying no to a lot of people by saying yes to this smaller group. Has that been, or was that scary? And then, how is that working for you now, having been intentional about saying, I'm going to say no to a lot of people? But that sounds like, yeah, I want to have a clear niche, and da, da, da. But then it's like, wait a minute, I'm going to say no to how many people? Like, then it gets scary, right?
Yeah.
How's that developed for you, and how's it working?
Yeah, absolutely. It was definitely scary in the beginning, because, you know, you're really tempted to take a lot of business that's maybe not good for you long term, or doesn't, you know, serve your target market long term. So I turned away a lot of business, and as a result, my business grew slower on the front end. Mm-hmm. But once you go all in, it's, you know, it picks up pretty quickly, and so you see the growth. But it's a little bit more painful in the beginning, for sure.
Yeah, that makes sense, and I appreciate you saying that you know, early on it may compromise the speed of your growth, but mm-hmm. But later on it pays off in that you are working with the right people for you, right? Tell me more about the team that you've assembled. How does that make your job easier as an advisor when someone brings up something that you don't do but relates to finance? Like, if you said, hey, everybody needs to have these five people, who are they?
Yeah. So for my clients, most of the people that we assemble are, you know, in addition to the CPA and the estate planning attorney, a lot of times we do need someone that specializes in family law to help with like prenuptial agreements. We also need insurance agents. I'm fee only. So I don't, you know, personally sell insurance products. So I have, you know, other and people that I work with that focus on, you know, whether it's life insurance or property and casualty insurance, or disability, things like that, long-term care. So I have agents that I work with specifically on those items as well. So those are kind of the main people that I assemble for clients.
What would your encouragement be to someone listening and says, you know, hey, that sounds great, but how do I vet those people so that I make sure that they're the best ones? I mean, I want to do the best for my customer, and certainly, you know, you want to give them the best options and best pricing, and you want it to be really smooth and fluid. Because if you say to someone, hey, I can help you with all these areas of your finance, mm-hmm. you know, but you're not doing it, you need to have a reliable team. Meaning, when I pass it, I need you to not drop the ball. I need you to be able to pass it to you and then give it back in an expedient way, in a professional way. So, I mean, does it just take some time did you have to go through some people and kind of go, hey, listen, this isn't working out. Like, you know, one strike, okay, two strikes, you're out kind of thing. I mean, how do you vet those people and make sure that they're serving your clients well?
Yeah, I spend a lot of time on the front end just learning about their experience, how they worked with clients in similar situations. Especially when it comes to a CPA, I think that's the hardest part.
Why is it the hardest? What do you think?
Well, just not every CPA is well-versed in equity compensation.
Sure.
And understands that. And I mean, a great example is right now I have a client who was previously working with a CPA who knew nothing about equity compensation. She was working with an advisor as well who didn't know about it.
Who also didn't know?
And she went through an IPO and the taxes were filed completely wrong. We're going back and doing amendments on her tax return, and she's going to get $100,000 refund.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So that's bad. I mean, I'm just thinking about that CPA and it's like, yeah. So was your client 50% enraged and 50% overjoyed?
Yes.
Not enraged with you, but it's like, what emotion am I going to pick? I want to go hurt this person, and then, you know, I want to hug, and I also want to hug Chloe. So which one should I do? You know?
Yeah.
So, that's amazing. I mean, I talking with many advisors, it is a mixed blessing, right? Cause you're like, I'm so grateful that I can help this person, but holy smokes, mm-hmm. they were in a bad place. What, when you talk about sort of working with that and creating that team, What's a temptation when you're trying to assemble those people that maybe, you know, hey, don't, you know, is it don't go too fast? Is it, you know, hey, if they mess up a few times, don't be afraid to cut ties. What's some of your advice on managing your idea partners, as we call them?
Yeah, I say the biggest thing is just don't be afraid to cut ties. And I feel like I've done a good job of judging like levels of competency with the people that I work with. The hardest part for me is sometimes the level of service. And, you know, I have a very high standard for the level of service that I provide to my clients.
Yeah.
And so if they come to me and say, you know, oh, this person's not being very responsive or they haven't.
That's almost always it, right? I mean, it's not that they're, you know, gave you bad advice necessarily. It's just like, hey, I need you to be communicative, right? I need you to get back with my people. You know, so that's usually it. And so what you're saying is, you've had to have those conversations where it's like, hey, it's not going to work out because, and maybe they're just legitimately busy, but I'm, you know, you're not going to send your people to someone that they're going to have to wait on, right?
Yeah. And I'm happy to have a conversation with that, you know, that other advisor and just say, hey, like, you know, I've heard this feedback from clients. Like, is this something that you can work on or just to see if there was something going on, you know, they had maybe a couple of rough cases or something. So,
yeah.
So yeah, give people grace and, you know, and more chances, but eventually if it's not working out, then I find someone else for my clients to work with.
Yeah. And I agree. I mean, I think you give people grace. You go, hey, help me understand what's happening versus jumping in and just saying what the, you know, blankety blankety blank. And, you know, but I also think that, you know, it's not baseball. So it's not three strikes and you're out. I think it's more of like a two strikes. Like the first time you go, hey, let me understand this. Great. I need that to not happen. You know, like mm-hmm. I want to work with you, but this needs not. And then the next time it happens, is that a fair, like, hey, you know what? You knew the expectation. I'm going to move on. So do you have multiple in each area? How do you manage that?
Well, it's usually what you just said. So I'll give someone a chance, and then and then if I still see an issue, then I'll move on to someone else.
Yeah. Well, I want to move on to something else, which is, and it's funny because it's a term that is not, people always kind of know what you're talking about when you say it, but it's also a very loosely defined term, which is kind of oxymoronic, you know, like jumbo shrimp or something like that. It's like, oh, I know what you mean, but I don't really know what you mean. And that is the term a lifestyle practice. So let me take a crack at it, and then you tell me. I'll give my guess of what that means. Most people think of a lifestyle practice as smaller team, perhaps smaller volume, managed assets, things like that, but mostly characterized by that you're not overwhelmed by your work, that you sort of, you love your work, you're good at what you do, but you always are protecting against it becoming too much, overcoming and becoming your life. So what does lifestyle practice mean to you? Because you describe yourself as having a lifestyle practice. So what does that mean on a practical level?
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar to what you said. For me, having a lifestyle practice means that, yeah, I'm building a business that supports like my ideal life and the life that I want to live. So for me, my goal has never been, you know, to make as much money as possible. And I know, you know, some of my colleagues think I'm crazy because of that, but I just want to make enough money to support the lifestyle that I want, to make sure I'm reaching my long-term goals towards financial independence. And, you know, if I ever do want to shut things down, I have that option to do it. But I'm building a business to where I feel like I can work in it indefinitely because it's something that I enjoy. It's not overwhelming or taking up so much time in my life that I feel like I need to escape from it.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate that last part, especially where you talk about not having to escape from it. I think that a way to test this, if you're listening or watching, a way to test this is, do you feel like you have to escape? And again, work is work. It can be hard at times. That's why it's called work, right? But if you find yourself wanting to escape from it more often than run, you know, towards it and say, I like this. I want to go do this. I'm excited about it. Then I think that is a measure of, you know, how much control or influence in a negative way does it have on your life? What has guided you towards or motivated you towards saying, hey, I'm going to design a lifestyle practice versus I think the industry just says more is good. Well, how much more? More, right? you know, and winning looks like this, which is, you know, you'll grow and you'll, right? And grow means you'll manage people. So what is your ideal lifestyle practice? Is it, you know, is it just like, you know, how much money you want to make and then you just go, okay, that's, I'm going to hold off there. And unless it's, meaning do you just cap it by like, hey, this is as much time and energy I want to put into it. How do you decide the parameters for you around lifestyle practice?
Yeah, I knew exactly how much I wanted to make and what that income goal was, you know, to be able to live comfortably and do all the things that I want to do and achieve my long-term goals. And so that was the first piece of it. And then also, yeah, just knowing how many hours I wanted to work and the other things that I wanted to fill my days and fill my time outside of working. And so the combination of those two things really helped me to establish how I wanted to build my business and helped with even pricing, number of clients, all of those things.
Let me ask you about a point of tension that I think some advisors might be feeling or have, especially if you're younger or maybe you're just in the habit or I think there are two groups. One, younger, meaning you're like, hey, I'm not turning away anything right now because I want to like pay my bills, right? And then the other is you've been in the business for a while, you're in a rhythm, but you do feel like it's become your life. It's become too much of it. It's really taken over in a way that you feel like it runs you more than you run it. So here's a question for both those groups that I think you can help them with is when did you make the decision that you felt like, okay, now I'm going to start to design this for my life because I'm good enough at it that I feel like I can do that. And sort of the question behind the question is it feels like you can't do that in the very beginning because for a while you have to just like eat right? But is it after you've survived for a certain number of years that you go, you know what? Now I know I can do this now. Now I'm going to start to sort of say no to some people and define my values better. Because I think some people just go, like, I don't have that luxury. And other people go, boy, I've really built myself into a box. How do I get out of it? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I've always had a vision for my life, even when I first started my career, that I wanted to get to the point where I can work part-time and still make enough money to live comfortably and be able to travel and volunteer and spend time with people that are important to me. So that was something that has always been in the back of my head.
Yeah.
I didn't always want to start a business. I thought I was going to be an employee, and that just kind of, you know, situations kind of brought me here. But I knew that that was the ultimate goal. And so, yeah, of course, in the beginning of my career, I had to work hard and build up my experience and time in the business. I've been in the business for, it'll be 20 years in a few months. And so, I still feel like I'm young though, and I have a lot more time to grow in the business, but yeah, that's kind of how that started. So yeah, if you are younger, it might be something that you have to work towards, and it might take a little bit of time to eventually get there. And as far as people who have large businesses that maybe realize that their business is running their life, or they're not happy in their business because they're spending more time managing people maybe than helping clients or doing the things that are important to them. I mean, I have plenty of colleagues, and I've seen people basically just completely get rid of all their employees and go back to being solo or just having one or two people to help them, and maybe even finding a home for other clients or selling a portion of their business off. So it is possible to take that step back if it's something that you realize that, you know, maybe you've built this business that you're not really happy with.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't know if you've heard that idea that, you know, one of the problems with climbing the ladder is you might have put it against the wrong wall, right? I climbed the ladder as I leaned against the wrong goal. And again, at Elite Advisor Network, our goal is to help advisors recognize and reach their potential faster. But I think that as an advisor, you get to decide, and a lot of advisors don't actually know this, but you get to decide what wall you put your ladder up against. Yeah. You get to decide, you know, what do I want to climb up to? And it's an important decision to make, because you may find yourself, you know, again, at the top of the wrong wall, and that's a pretty discouraging feeling, right?
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh yeah. I was just going to say, I a couple of weeks ago, like every spring I go speak to the students at University of Georgia, the financial planning students. And the last piece of advice I left them with was, you know, really take the time to learn who you are, what's important to you, you know, what your core values are, and what you want your life to look like, because that can really impact like a lot of life decisions that you make. And, you know, even when you think about like finding a partner and getting married or just like friendships that you build or your profession or your career growth, all of those things are affected by having a good understanding of who you are and what's important to you, and making sure that you find people or situations that are aligned with that.
Well, I really appreciate that. And I want to leave our listeners with that thought. One of my greatest mentors in my life, who passed away recently, he said that finding the right career is 80% understanding who you are and 20% finding what do you want to do with that. And I think that echoes your advice to those students, and my advice to our listeners and viewers is, you know, the other is that it's never too late to change, right? Yeah. You know, my mentor, he found success much later in life. You know, he wandered through much of his life from idea to idea and business to business, and he had joy, and he raised a beautiful family and was faithful to his wife and had, you know, a great life, but he didn't really, you know, figure stuff out till probably his late 40s. I always think about that as sort of like the Colonel Sanders effect, because if people, you know, knew about Colonel Sanders and the story of KFC, like he became successful in like his 60s, you know what I mean? And so don't wait that long, but if you're already there, you can still turn the ship around. So, yeah. Well, Chloe, thank you for your time and your story, and thank you for the example that you provide advisors to become elite in their own way and to make sure that the goals you're reaching are your own. And thank you for your example to them. And thank you for your time with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me again.